You're listening to 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia, Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's not just radio, it's community radio, on the web at kopn.org. And this is Speaking of the Arts. Good morning and welcome to Speaking of the Arts on KOPN, Mid-Missouri's only in-depth weekly art show. My name is Diana Moxon. On last week's show, I chatted with Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read coordinator, Lauren Williams, about this year's One Read book, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, written by journalist Jessica Bruder. Coming up later in the show, we take that conversation one step further with author Jessica Bruder herself. But first, did you know that it takes 15,000 litres of water to make one pair of jeans? That 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions are produced by the apparel and footwear industries, and this one kills me, or that nearly 60% of all clothing produced ends up being burnt or landfilled within 1 year of being produced. There is a lot of talk in the $2.5 trillion fashion industry about making the sector more sustainable and less polluting, but what does that really look like? As in many industries, greenwashing abounds, and the basic fact remains that we make and buy clothes at an unsustainable level. But there are some companies doing amazing work with cellulose, bacteria, and even mushrooms to create new biodegradable and sustainable fibers. And here in Columbia at the University of Missouri's Department of Textile and Apparel Management, a 3-year exhibit series is exploring our use of flora, fauna, and earth elements and is asking students to design garments which reflect a thoughtful statement about key issues surrounding environmental conservation and which inspire positive social change. Joining me from the Missouri Historic Costume and Textile Collection is Collection Manager Nicole Johnston, Curator and Professor Jean Parsons, and two of Jean's students, Jenny Wu and Chance Sahais. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thank you.
So, Jean, you are the curator for the Textile and Apparel Management Collection. I'm guessing that there are a lot of people, myself included, that have only scant knowledge that a collection exists. So give us an overview of what is in the collection.
We have quite a sizable collection. We have 7,000 pieces at this point, at least. It includes textiles, apparel. Our earliest garments go back to the late 1820s. All the way up to today, we continue to collect because what we collect today will be historic garments in the future. We also have shoes, hats, accessories, and all of those other things. It's used in the class. I take a dozen pieces to my class every week when I teach history for education and then for outreach and exhibits.
And how do you acquire them?
Most of them are donations. We get donated pieces from alums, people who know about us. We try to focus on pieces that have a Midwest provenance. So we are a state university, so we do try to keep it focused on things that relate to Missouri or the Midwest in general. The Midwest has had a lot of apparel production in its history, so we try to get some of those pieces as well.
And how many are on display at any one time? I mean, I guess like most museums, most of the work is hidden or in storage. Do you have a changing exhibit of works that are in the collection?
Yes. We have an exhibit, our fall exhibit, and then a summer exhibit. The spring exhibit is in our exhibit cases is actually dedicated to student work. And then we have collaborations actually across the state at this point. There are a few pieces down in the Capitol in their exhibit down there. We have had pieces, well, we'll be doing a large exhibit with the new State Historical Society museums and their galleries in the spring.
Fantastic. Nicole, the new exhibit, Flora and Fashion, is part of a 3-year series of exhibits called Origins, Dress and Textiles. Tell us the backstory to the series.
Well, we celebrated our 50th anniversary in, 2016? And from that point, we wanted to kind of explore and reintroduce the materials and the collection to the public to start our next 50 years. So we settled on a series that does explore the materials, the variety of materials that we use to make our clothing and textiles.
And the first year was, and it was called Endangered Fauna and Fashion, and that was developed to celebrate also the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. Is that
yes,
right?
And the 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And the website has, oh goodness, over 140 pieces and some great information about the history of the use of animal products and the exploitation that has occurred over time.
Really looking at those images on the website gave me pause for thought in realizing that I really didn't know what was in the collection, because there are really phenomenal works that
yes,
you have
are.
In that 7,000 strong collection. I'd love to come over and see more. So the current show, Flora and Fashion, tell me what ideas you're exploring in that.
We are looking at some of the most basic, most common materials used in apparel, and that's going to be cotton and linen for the most part. And the processes that are used to make those, take those fibers, take those materials and turn them into fibers that can be used for clothing, and the agricultural processes and the chemicals and all of the processes that go into turning these materials into fibers and yarns.
The environmental concerns of all of that production.
Mm-hmm. And exploring the variety of materials. We don't necessarily use some of the kinds of materials that are in the exhibit, like pineapple and bark cloth and things like that. So it's fun to get those out of the collection and have people learn about them and be able to see them.
Jean, there are a lot of eye-opening and shocking statistics about the negative environmental impact of the textile and fashion industry. How much do the school's courses focus on the industry and kind of best practices?
I think it's built into a lot of courses. It's not a full focus of any single course, but we talk about it a lot in a whole variety of courses. We have production courses. We have marketing, merchandising courses. So it gets discussed at all levels and in all courses.
Jenny and Chance, you are starting out in this conflicted industry. What are your hopes for the future?
I think that we are really lucky to be coming into the industry at a time when this new kind of movement of sustainability and social responsibility by companies is not only new, but is starting to be expected by consumers, and people are becoming more aware of the issues that have been created by the industry for years and years and years. So I think that gives us a lot of opportunity as designers to kind of branch out a little bit and give consumers something that they haven't seen before in a way that, you know, still keeps the environment and all of those things at the forefront.
Jenny, do you see a change in shopping habits of your generation?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think for now, like sustainable clothing, they're also moving to like designer market. And also I'm from China, so the large clothing like consuming market. And I can tell that there's definitely the high awareness of using more sustainable material and also using more like environmental eco-friendly clothing. And I think that's like a really good thing for the whole industry.
That's great to hear, because I mean, your country is producing so much
yeah,
for the rest
I know.
Of the world.
Yeah.
And consuming so much for the, you know, such a big population. Jean, you have a program, a student project called Artwear Off the Wall, and that ties into this Origins exhibit series. Tell us a little bit about that.
I teach a class called Creativity and Problem Solving, and their first project to get them into the course is something where they have to create an artwear project that hangs on the wall, and then they have to be able to take it off the wall and put it on the body in some way. So it goes from 2D to 3D in some form. And it is themed. Last year it was themed to the animal exhibit, and this year it's themed to our plant exhibit. They have a very large range of projects they can choose from. I didn't limit it particularly this year, as long as it was plant-based and plant-inspired. So there's a range of things that students are working on.
And it has to be wearable.
It has to be wearable. I would say it's not something you're going to, it's artwear.
So you might wear it to a fancy event. You're not going to wear it to go down the shops or go to the gym.
Exactly.
Okay. Chance, tell us about your design and its inspiration.
My design is actually inspired by the flax plant, which is what linen is grown from and produced from. And it's a very ancient kind of fiber. It's actually older than cotton and dates, you know, back to many different regions and cultural practices and different religious practices as well. So that's where I drew my inspiration from, was the actual plant fiber itself. And from that, I am creating a Mobius strip, which is an infinity circle in a sense. And it's kind of all about how life is a constant circle, but in that transition and change, that's the big turning point, and that's culturally significant to everybody and just kind of the circle of life.
What was it that attracted you to linen and flax?
It's really easy to work with. It's a wonderful fabric. I actually tea bag dyed it, so it picks up colors really well, and you can have a lot of body and like loftiness to it, but you can also get a lot of structure out of the garment as well. So that's something that I really wanted to incorporate, was a mix of those two elements.
And what is the garment? Is it a scarf? Like, how do you wear it?
So still in the process of designing that part. Hopefully in the end, it will be more as like a wrap that goes around the body. So it's not necessarily a complete garment that you would be wearing in public or anything like that, but it would encompass the body in the same sense that the linen is not only sheltering the body that's wrapped around you, but the cultural significance behind it. Egyptians use linen to wrap the body as it's passing on to the next life. And, you know, a lot of other religions practice the same thing. And so it's also the metaphor that it's sheltering your soul as well, in a sense.
So it's an adornment.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Jenny, what is the inspiration behind your design?
So my design is inspired by leaf vines. They are vines that are visible on the leaf and supporting the whole system of the to keep the leaf healthy. And also, I'm also inspired by an art project that I did when I was in China, when I was in primary school, that we make skeleton leaf bookmarks. And we boil leaf with chemicals and remove the flesh from the vine and also dye them and make them into beautiful bookmarks. And the final project is sheer. And also has a beautiful soft beige color on it. So I combine its color and the beautiful detailed structure of leaf vines to make a wearable art. And also, I think the meaning of it is like leaf vines, they are not like really easy to notice when they are in the not in the form of a skeleton leaf. But actually, I think leaf vines, they are like people, they are like silently dedicate themselves to the whole society and give back to the world, because like in China, there were like street cleaners that have to wake up like 3 a.m. in the morning and clean up the street, and after maybe finish till 7, and after people like waking up and go to work, but they don't even notice them. So it's like me paying a devotion to people like them. Yeah.
And so what does your garment look like?
Oh, so my garment is going to be made of organza, and I'm going to paint all the vines with silk paint, and also it's going to be in the shape of a twisted leaves. And also when you put on the wall, it's gonna look like a painting, like a rectangle, but you can take it off and just twist it and wear it on the body in any kind of form.
Wow, that sounds amazing. So you're painting that vine, the skeleton leaves. You're not doing the same chemical process you did when you were a child.
No, but I'm gonna add up with some actual skeleton leaves and also some different kind of color to create a texture of it.
And will both of these works be in the upcoming exhibit, Flora and Fashion, or will they come later?
They will be on display during our exhibit opening on Friday the 20th.
Next Friday. Mm-hmm. And so at the opening next Friday, all the students who have work in the show will hopefully be there, so you can talk to them about their designs.
Yes, you'll be able to talk to them about their process and their inspiration. We did this last year with the endangered pieces, and the students really enjoyed it, and the visitors, they learned a lot. It was really nice.
But in addition to the student work, there'll also be work from the collection that reflects that flora components of fashion, is that right?
Yes. Our exhibit case will contain anywhere from 20 to 25 pieces, including some of those unique materials that we've talked about already.
Talk a little bit more about that. So on your website, you have a great page about alternative mm-hmm. fabrics, and you list a few, the cellulose and bark and mushrooms.
Yeah, and that's just a few. There are so many new processes that designers are really they're exploring quite a bit in terms of sustainability and just utilizing different kinds of materials in new ways.
And are those fabrics available for students to work with, or are they prohibitively expensive at this point in time?
There are some that are available. I had a student who was actually last semester who was working with bamboo leather. It's a leather, faux leather that's made out of bamboo, and that was actually quite beautiful. They have to special order them, of course. So
right.
A few students are of working with what's available.
I mean, it's super interesting. There's a company called Bolt Threads, I think, that you mentioned on your website, who are
the mushrooms,
the mushroom people,
the mycelium.
And spider web. So they have worked out, found the proteins that are used in spider web, and they're creating material based on those spider web proteins, which sounds phenomenal.
Fascinating.
It's a little bit away from being available on the high street, I think.
Yeah, not quite yet. Not quite yet. We'll get there, hopefully.
Zooming out again to the textile industry as a whole, there's a lot of talk about companies becoming more sustainable. European fashion chain Zara and its parent company recently pledged that by 2025, all of their brands will only use cotton, linen, and polyester. That's organic, sustainable, or recycled, but that just seems like a huge amount of greenwashing. Like, really, they're still opening stores, they're still producing, what is it, 20,000 items a year of clothing or something. Is there anyone out in the fashion world who is truly making a difference?
Yes. There, yes, there is.
On the spot question.
And there are many companies who are becoming more and more transparent, where you can get onto the website and you can see every step of every process. So you can follow it from beginning to end. Some companies are doing genetic typing of their fibers and their materials. So if they say it is a certain type of fiber, you can literally trace that fiber.
Where it was grown,
or how it was made, or who made it.
And that's to also help reduce what goes into the landfills as well.
Right.
I mean, you can trace where it's going and help impact the end result of where that material,
it helps the consumer to know what they're buying.
That statistic I had at the beginning, about 60%, nearly 60% of all clothing produced ends up being burnt or buried. That isn't just what you and I throw away. It's that companies that are producing giant amounts of fast fashion won't just give it away or sell it. They have to destroy it after that. So that's what most of that nearly 60% is.
They're choosing to destroy it, yes.
Yeah. Right. Last question, Jenny and Chance, are you hopeful about the future for your industry?
I think it's bright. I think that a lot of companies are taking steps in the right direction, and the more companies that are starting up are doing it right from the beginning. So I have hope.
Yeah, and for me, I hope the apparel industry in China, since they have a large production, can really pay attention to this, and I wish I can maybe make some effort to it. Yeah.
Are you going to get back to China after graduating?
I'm open for all the opportunities. But, yeah.
Oh, you are great hope. Thank you so much to my guests today, Professor Jean Parsons, Nicole Johnston, Jenny Wu, and Chance Zahais. The opening reception for the exhibit Flora and Fashion will be at Gwynn Hall from 4:30 till 6 p.m. next Friday, September the 20th. And you'll be able to view the exhibit and chat to the students who have their innovative designs in the show. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you for inviting us.
You're listening to Speaking of the Arts on 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia. And after a short break, I'll be chatting to Jessica Bruder, author of this year's One Read book, Nomadland. Do not wander off. Welcome back to Speaking of the Arts. This year's One Read book, Nomadland, is sparking interesting conversations in book groups, in bars, and at One Read panel discussions across the Daniel Boone Regional Library communities. Discussions about issues such as how we deal with people who are houseless, the gig economy, stagnation of wages, rising rental costs, and exactly why an increasing number of older Americans are either choosing to or being forced to live a nomadic lifestyle. I caught up with the author of Nomadland, journalist Jessica Bruder, earlier this week in a wide-ranging Skype chat. It is a delight to welcome to the show, from her apartment in Brooklyn, New York, the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, Jessica Bruder. Welcome to Speaking of the Arts, Jess.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know how much you know about Columbia's One Read program, but it is an incredibly well-organized month-long schedule of events and discussions. And so many people in Columbia are reading your book and looking forward to seeing you on September the 24th. Have you been part of a One Read program in any other communities?
No, it's exciting and slightly terrifying, but in a good way. Because when you do a project like this, you kind of have to zone out the fact that people will actually read it when you're done. So I'm excited. I'm thrilled. I have a little bit of performance anxiety. So I just hope I'll live up to what the community has done, because I go on Twitter and I see that there's an art exhibition going on and just all this other stuff. And because I love the topic so much, it's incredible to see other people riffing on it and kind of participating in just the thought and the community around it. To me, that's super exciting.
I know this book began life as a cover story for Harper's, but how did you come across the story and how did you find Linda?
The Linda thing is kind of hilarious. How I found the story is a little bit boring, actually. I read a lot. I'm a journalist. I'm really fascinated by the analog backlot of the digital economy and how labor issues work in the modern world. And I'm also fascinated with subcultures. And I think I'm also a bit of a hippie at heart. I grew up, you know, I was born in the late 70s and kind of missed all that. So the on the road stuff has always been super appealing to me. I had been reading about labor in Amazon warehouses, and that's how I first came across the Camper Force program, which is essentially a program that targets people who live full-time on the road but need to have a steady income. So a lot of what I call pseudo-retirees, a lot of people who are on the road but can't really afford to just hang out and camp. So once I started looking into Camper Force, Amazon's program, I saw that there's this whole sprawling economy of work camping. And a lot of it had grown in the wake of the housing crash. And I just thought this was fascinating, both the subculture, the bonds, the ways people make this life, and also just the fact that the economy had been failing large numbers of American people who were just saying, you know, forget this, I'm going to go do it on my own and find a different kind of tribe and a different kind of family. So that absolutely fascinated me. Gosh, the other half of the question.
How did you meet Linda specifically?
Oh, Linda. Okay, so the first time, so I was working, I'd pitched a story to Harper's, and actually the first gentleman I was going to write about had to bail. He was the only person I'd met who was hired on full-time by Amazon, and he was terrified to speak to the media. He was afraid he would get the ACS, the Amazon cold shoulder, his retirement plans would be dashed, and said, please don't write about me. And while, you know, it was all on the record and I'm a journalist, I'm a human first. So, of course, I wasn't going to burn this gentleman. So before I knew it, I was out in Quartzsite, Arizona, talking to lots of nomads. I did not know who the main character of the story would be. I was running scared. I had never written for Harper's before. And Linda still remembers the first thing I said to her. It was, can I pet your dog? She likes to joke that she'll write a memoir called Can I Pet Your Dog? So she and I met at an event called the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which is essentially a Skillshare for nomads. And I ended up there really by chance. I'd been living out of a tent with a rental car for a few weeks just trying to meet people. And it was really fortuitous that we met.
Was it always Linda who was going to be the main character in your book? Did anybody else? Like, it seems like Bob Wells, who I have a little bit of a philosophical crush on. He's just such a sweet man. Was he ever going to be the central character, or did you know from the get-go that Linda was it?
Well, it was interesting because a lot of there were a few reasons to go with Linda. And, you know, Bob is very good at telling Bob's story. He has a website. He has a following. As a journalist who likes to go out and talk to people and find stories myself, there's something about just spending a long time talking to people and teasing out these stories that haven't already been told and retold. From my perspective, also, it was very exciting to write a road book that focused on women, because I have friends, gosh, my best friend was on the road hopping freights in the 80s with a bunch of people who'd kind of been pushed out of traditional work and were seeking work, and it was all men. And if you look at the canon of road books, whether it's On the Road or Travels with Charlie or Blue Highways, so many of these books are guy books. But when I got out there, I saw so many older women, and I thought this was a really interesting opportunity to do a book that dealt with many of the same issues, but from a slightly different central perspective. That, and the fact that many of the people I met on the road were just trying to figure out what they were going to do next week or next month. And from a narrative perspective, Linda had a plan. I said, Linda, what are you going to do? And she went and took a three-ring binder out and told me about this great dream of building an Earthship. And as a narrative writer, you know, we look for questions and quests and ways that we can keep the readers hanging on to a journey. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, just having that opportunity to follow somebody through that sort of quest was really exciting.
Right at the beginning of the book, you talk about how there's hope on the road. You write, there's a bone-deep conviction that something better will come. But you also write about how, unlike in the 1930s, where there was a precedent of a population on the move, most of the current nomads do not envisage ever going back, of ever having a brick and mortar home again, that they plan to live in hiding on and off until they die. So when they talk about something better to come, what is that?
I think there's just, again, there's this feeling when you're on the road, this forward momentum that, you know, this idea that you can cast off the shackles of mainstream society and that all you need is a tank of gas and a cup of tepid gas station coffee and you're on to the next thing. And that you can constantly be renewing and reinventing yourself with the next job, the next people you'll meet, the next amazing landscape. You know, it's also got scary components. You know, many of the people I met, there's no social safety net anymore. And right. One broken axle could land them capital H homeless. So a lot of people are, you know, they're trying to get out of the debt trap. They're trying to live within their means. They're trying to get out of this situation where wages are flat, retirement finance is a mess, and housing prices keep going up. And they just want to live their lives. And they can't really imagine reintegrating with that system. But also, as you get older and older, how do you stay on the road? That was another challenge that I saw. And everybody who's been doing this for a while knows somebody who's died on the road. Right. And that's a reality, too. And you know, as one of the people in the book brought up when I was talking to her about it, well, everybody's going to die somewhere. So for many people, dying in the wilderness in a van is in no way worse than passing away, and in many ways better than passing away over-medicated in some sort of facility, which they would find depressing and confining.
As this community develops, are they developing their own social safety network? So yes, you're broken axle and you are homeless. You are not just houseless, but then you are also homeless. Do they have a means of supporting each other? Is that something that's under development?
It's absolutely under development. When I was first on the road with people in 2014, it was very informal. So if somebody broke down and there was a group of people, everybody would pass the hat. And you know, the generosity you'd see among people who had economically very little was staggering. People would always help each other get back on the road or, you know, just provide whatever sort of solidarity or support was needed if somebody gets sick or a van breaks down. Nowadays, there's something pretty cool going on. There's the Homes on Wheels Alliance, which Bob Wells and other folks, Sue Ann Carlson, other folks who are affiliated with the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous and that crew have started this nonprofit to work with people who are new to the road, are facing economic challenges, and to be kind of a source of education, support, and hopefully also some kinds of material aid. So that's a pretty new nonprofit, but I'm pretty excited to see what they do. It's more formal than a lot of these just friend and kin-based networks of mutual aid that I'd seen when I was on the road.
One of the many things that is captivating about the book is the number of myths that you shatter. And so for me, perhaps the most earth-shaking, as you've talked about and Bob Wells mentions, the breaking of the social contract, that like many of the people you meet, you can be earning a six-figure salary or have multiple degrees, a solid career, you can regularly pay off your credit cards, and yet for one bad moment in time, you are suddenly a nomad. Did you find much resentment or bitterness on the road?
I mean, I found a lot of people who'd basically said, look, I could wallow on a couch somewhere and be a burden on friends and family. That's not to say friends and family would have thought of them that way. But a lot of the people who have the wherewithal to get up and get out and try something new are really propelled by this optimism. I mean, it takes a lot of energy to do what they've done and to kind of maintain that. So a lot of the people I met, when they're talking about it, this is our counterculture. This is a new tribal affiliation. Often it's filling a gap that biological family hadn't. You know, hopefully when people do this in community, they're finding a sort of acceptance. But I know also when people, you know, there are these gatherings, but when people disperse again, it can be difficult and it can be lonely. But I think people don't want us to come to bitterness, because then what do? You right. know, and it's not productive. You've got to keep getting up and going in the morning. And so people are making the best of it.
I sense that sadness and isolation. And when you'd have these, they'd go to these great meetings, the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, this Quartzsite, there's Ehrenberg, and they all get together and they're having a great time. And then there is that moment when it ends and you set out and you don't know when you're going to see these awesome people again. They're just transient in your life. And the difficulty of having a lifestyle where you're constantly saying goodbye to people was very poignant for me.
Yeah, I felt it when I was out there at Rubber Tramp too. And it's really exciting when you actually get there and you see people who have been there in past years re-encountering each other. But the fact that you don't know for sure if that's going to happen, there is always a bittersweet feeling when these encampments kind of break up and people move on.
So to truly understand the nuances of this nomadic community, you became one of them. You brought a van, which you named Halen, and I love all the van names in the book. And then you spent 2 years off and on out on the road. So at the end of that time, what were the truths that you better understood that you hadn't before? And as someone who ultimately does have a home to return to, are there still truths and nuances that you don't understand about this community?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. One thing I always really wanted to make clear is, as somebody who practices immersion journalism, the goal is never to become one of the people you're writing about. You really need to keep in mind that to some degree, you're always going to be a tourist. Right. So I used to joke with them that I'm not a nomad, I'm a FOMAD. A couple times I needed to go undercover to get what I was writing about. That was at Amazon and at the sugar beet harvest. But otherwise, everybody always knew, I'm here, I'm a documentarian, I live in New York, I'm a part-time professor, and I'm here because I want to be on the scene 24/7 to understand better what it means, but not because I think that somehow I'm becoming you and this is about me. So that's pretty important to me. But gosh, I learned a lot. And immersion can surprise you because you also feel like, oh, heck, I'm a tourist. I'm not going to have feelings about this, right? But my first night sleeping somewhere I wasn't really legal to sleep. I'd also just been bit in the leg by a chihuahua. I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is a horrible idea. Every time headlights went by, I was completely paranoid. So it's funny how much things can get under your skin just if you're spending a lot of time in the communities and trying to spend some time in the shoes of people you're writing about. But yeah, I learned a lot about camaraderie and solidarity and the kind of joyful lightness of certain types of minimalism, realizing that there are some terrors that I didn't encounter. I did break down a bunch of times. I blew an alternator in Kansas. I screwed up some brakes going down a steep incline because I have always driven automatic in flat areas of the country. I was driving an 8,000-pound van, and, that's not something I'd really done before. I'd wired it for solar. I managed to flood it. I managed to do just everything you could probably do to a van. But, I'm a journalist. I live in New York. I have another job. So I was never stuck on the side of the road and just kind of screwed. So you're trying to kind of recognize that you may share some feelings that allow you to write other people's experiences better, but that you're never going to have the same depth of experience, which is why it's important not to get wrapped up in what you're feeling and to really continue to be just the biggest listener of everyone else's stories you can, and just try to use your experience to step inside their stories and tell them more richly rather than to say, hey, this is about me.
The spell that you spent, or is it a day or 2 days at the sugar beet harvest in Minnesota, was probably the hardest part of the book for me to read in terms of knowing what everyone else was going through and how awful it sounded. Just misery, absolute misery for 12 hours a day, and how tough the people were to stick it out who were twice your age.
I know. And I think I was there for about a week. I've kind of blocked it out mentally a little bit. I'd have to go back and look. I just remember I was supposed to be there. I guess, it usually lasts for about a month. And I was there for about a week. And I felt incredibly guilty leaving. And then it turned out that the station I was assigned to was so bad and so rough that just about everybody else jumped ship after I did. We were doing these 12-hour shifts. The four women who went to work in pink cowboy boots and a full face of makeup, which I say, go for it. Why not? But she was really, she would point to one side of this giant machine and basically sound a horn that sounded like they were arming the nuclear submarines. And this was the sign that we had to go shovel beets. And some of these beets were the size of basketballs. Mm. These huge diesel trucks would be dumping them into these hoppers and they would inevitably miss. And while heavy machinery is supposed to, you're supposed to have these bobcats that come around and help clean, we never really had enough of that. So really, it ended up, on our backs to just shovel and shovel and shovel and to, at one point, climb into the machine to clean it. And people were getting hurt. I was only there for a few days. My body hurt. I was in my mid to late 30s at the time and figured, if people in their 70s can do this, I'm fine. And I was a wreck.
How were people in their 70s doing it?
I don't know. I think some of them were on easier stations than I was. I think I got a pretty bad shift. I think some of them were just doing their best to stick it out. I was camping next to one fellow who had to beg to get off the night shift because he was a retired trucker who was going blind. His wife had ALS. They were both in some pretty rough shape, and he was on the night 12-hour shift and had to beg to get on the day shift. I just don't know. I think some people who have done it for a while end up requesting light duty stuff. So you could work in the lab and taking sugar samples. So if you're kind of an insider, you can kind of jockey for easier jobs. But the ground crew job, which everybody starts out at, I just don't know. And it wasn't all older people. It was kind of a mix of older people and younger crust punks, which was weird because I was in my 30s. So everybody, I was in this weird in-between place where all these people in their 20s or in their 50s, 60s, 70s. There was one night I was so tired coming off shift that I think I made macaroni and cheese and I tried to watch this Wallace and Gromit movie. It was like Shaun the Sheep or something. And the sheep is in like this runaway car going downhill. And I remember thinking, oh God, this is just too stressful. I can't watch this. Like I was that dead that it just, this comedy movie was just, it was really stressing me out. I just needed to sleep.
One of my favorite pieces of Bob's advice, and I wondered if you did this before you set off. He said how you should spend a few nights basically living in a cardboard walled corner of your bedroom.
I love that.
Did you do that?
No, I didn't do that. I didn't do that.
I love the stages. First of all, live in your bedroom and then put up cardboard walls and live in a cardboard walled corner of your bedroom. Like do it in stages. Get used to it.
I just kind of jumped in all at once and had the inevitable. You wake up, you hit your head on the ceiling, all that good stuff.
So having lived to some degree in the nomadic world and in the bricks and mortar world, where would you rather be? Because you wrote about how the first few nights back in your apartment felt kind of odd and it was huge and you missed the road.
Yeah, they felt totally weird. And I did miss the road and I missed being in a van because frankly, I won't lie to you, my van is much tidier than my apartment. In my van, I have few possessions. There's a place for everything. When I'm at home, I'm usually kind of snowed in with work and things just get kind of crazy. I do like having a home base because I'm kind of a plant junkie. Like I love gardening. You know, I have my dog, I have this job and students that I love and a lot of the stuff that I like to do. You know, I've played in some bands, like a lot of the things that I do in New York rely on me being here all the time to kind of have that sort of community. So in that way, I do like being rooted. But in another way, I really thought that after the book was over, I would probably give up the van. I bought a low mileage vehicle. I got a good deal on it. I said, this is, you know, this will be a part of my life. And it didn't. I actually was just out in it for about 10 days. And it's become a permanent part of my life. One, I haven't really figured out quite how it fits with the rest, but I'm pretty obsessed with the van.
I spent 20 years roaming around the world without a home, and that was perfectly fine. Yet now that I have a home, reading the book made me really anxious because I felt like this solid rock that I thought I was now standing on was suddenly just quicksand and that I was not nearly prepared enough for my older years. And any safety net that I thought that I had was just gossamer. I mean, it just wasn't really there. It was just in my head. And even just writing, you know, my questions to talk to you and thinking about it again, I got all knotted up in my stomach. It just gives me this kind of sense of fear. And I was used to being homeless. How do you feel about old age now, having lived this life?
That's a really good question. I remember when I first got an apartment in New York, when I was renting, buying furniture scared the daylights out of me. I felt like every stick of furniture I owned was something I couldn't fit in a backpack, right? And was something that was kind of pinning me down. So the idea of having another time in my life where maybe I'm working a little bit less and being more minimal in a weird way is appealing. I mean, obviously, doing this project underscored the importance of saving to me. You know, I've been a 401k nerd since I got out of college. I think I kind of had that beaten into me by my parents. So there will be something, but it's weird. We're in a culture that's obsessed with work, that's obsessed with youth, that tells you you're a citizen, that says that somehow to be a real person, you need a traditional house and you need a job and that these things are all wrapped up in identity. And I think it's really valuable to start to untangle that. And I think that's a question that will come up with me in tandem with aging. I'm 41 now. I love writing. I'm really grateful. I'm not like an athlete or a gymnast or something where it's like there's a shelf life on your job and you have to totally reinvent yourself. So I think to some degree, I will be working for a very long time. But again, you know, I'm not doing the sugar beet harvest.
So for a lot of the people that you write about, it was the recession of 2008 foreclosures and the cost of unproportionate cost of housing or rent to wages that launched them on the road. But is that really where it started, or can you track it back further than that? When did this phenomenon start?
I mean, gosh, we saw this starting around the time of the Great Depression, but people, as you mentioned, always imagined getting off the road, that the economy would kind of normalize. In more recent years, you know, we've had minimum wage stuck since the 70s, right? So it's funny. I think a lot of people, I kind of wonder if anybody would be reading Nomadland if Trump hadn't been elected, because people are saying, you know, what's going wrong? What's up with the quote-unquote forgotten middle class? But the bottom line is the book was reported mostly under Obama, and many of the issues it deals with are related to longstanding problems with economic inequality, which people only started talking about with Occupy Wall Street and later. The fact that minimum wage has been flat since the 70s, the fact that the gig economy is becoming the new norm, the fact that there are just all these protections that the labor industry, these hard-won gains over many years, are getting rolled back, whether it was the 40-hour work week and having a weekend or paid sick leave, just all this stuff is kind of going out the window, and it's a slower process, and it's not good.
I was looking on the Camperforce website this week to see what they were offering, and all the warehouses were already full for the upcoming season. I think there was one warehouse that still had jobs available. And I wonder, what is like the unemployment like in the Nomad community? I mean, theoretically, they can go anywhere at any time, so they don't need to be unemployed. But I mean, I'm sure that some people apply to be on the Amazon Camperforce because it's a solid 3 months of work and then they don't get places. Is there a sense of unemployment?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. People think, oh, they can go wherever they want. But for a lot of people, the gas money to get to these jobs is significant. So when we picture people on the road, you kind of imagine all these dots crisscrossing America. But people often do these much more localized orbits. So if you're somebody who's mostly out west, a lot of these Camperforce jobs are back east. So sometimes people will spend a lot of money and make a difficult journey in a precarious vehicle just to get there. I haven't heard of this with Camperforce, but there are other jobs where, because like Camperforce, these are at-will jobs, right? So you can be terminated at any time for no reason. I've heard of cases where people have traveled all the way across the country just to be told by the employer, oh, sorry, we don't need you anymore. And then that person's in the hole for gas and expenses. So a lot of people I've met are out there trying to get these jobs. And a lot of other people are just doing their best to live, just keep their overhead as low as possible.
Talking about Amazon, I've long felt ambivalent about Amazon. I see what it's doing to the local economies. I see what it's doing to the local shops. I don't really want to shop at Amazon. Sometimes it's the only place you can find what you're looking for. So after reading the book, I thought, I'm never shopping at Amazon again. I'm just done. I mean, it's so predatory. Then I think, well, you know, if I didn't shop at Amazon, if we all stopped shopping at Amazon, then this whole workforce would be out of a job. How do you feel about Amazon?
Like a nice piece of rationalization, I hate to say it. Amazon is a symptom of a much bigger economic issue. It's funny because I'm a writer and a storyteller, and after the book came out, I felt like politicians and everybody just wanted me to be this jack-in-the-box where they push the button and I'd hit Amazon with a mallet. But the truth is, we are in this winner-take-all system. Mm. We are in a system where these huge monopolies are taking over. At the end of the day, they're not good for consumers. You're talking about how nowadays there are some things you can only find on Amazon. That's largely because Amazon has pushed a lot of the smaller players out of the market. That's not good. And it's not good for the consumer, but it's also not good for the worker. So the bigger issue here is an issue of monopoly. And I think it's a huge problem. And I do think that people should think about where they spend their money and vote with that. Because frankly, if we didn't have these huge corporate monopolies, I think workers would be in a better spot. Wages might be in a better place. So while you can argue that, you know, maybe short term it would hurt Camperforce, Camperforce is really a drop in the bucket.
So do you shop at Amazon?
So I'm not a fascist. Let me give you an example. Recently, I went and looked everywhere. I've got these recessed, weird bulbs in my ceiling, and it would have cost me $100 more to buy them somewhere else. So I bought them on Amazon. But otherwise, I have gone through some pretty funny contortions to try to shop with smaller retailers because I think it's really good to support them. And also often that money you spend goes directly back into their communities. You know, I would urge people to just think about what do you actually really need? You know, right. As a consumer, not just who do you buy from, but how much scrap do you really need? And can you get it in a way that helps forge connections in your community or with a company where you think they're doing really cool stuff and that you think that they're thinking about the culture they're in? So I think these things are worth thinking about. And I know we're all under tremendous time pressure. Believe me, I feel it too. But, you know, it's just about being part of our culture and thinking about what you want that to look like.
Talking of economy, this is an alternative community that maybe doesn't need to use money or buy things in the same way. Is there a barter economy within this community?
I mean, it's almost more of a gift economy than a barter economy than, hey, I've got that, give me this. You just see a lot of generosity out there where when people are constantly trying to get rid of things because they don't have room for them in their vans, and there are always people who are looking for things and needing things. So I feel like it often happens over Facebook. A lot of people are members of Facebook groups, and people will just kind of identify vehicles that, you know, I always see people posting things off of Craigslist to these van dweller groups where it's like, hey, there's this van here. Is anybody looking? Or I don't need this part anymore. Would anybody like it? So it's more of a potluck supper than a transactional interaction.
I guess like any society, there are hoarders.
Yeah, but it hurts your gas mileage. Right. There's only so much hoarding you can do.
Talking of gas, I mean, it seems like this whole community is predicated on the availability of relatively cheap gas. Is there talk about electric vehicles and looking into the future? Like what happens when we don't have availability of gas? Has that discussion come up?
Again, absolutely. First of all, a lot of people I met don't travel as much as people would imagine. A lot of the people I met, even if they're living out of vehicles, they're actually probably using less gas than somebody who has a daily commute in a car culture, like in the area around LA, for example, because their ranges can often be quite small with occasional big trips. The other thing that's super cool is solar panels. The price of solar has dropped incredibly in the past decade or so. And, you know, when you're out in the Southwest, when you're out in the West, you'll often see people who have solar panels mounted on their vans. I did that, and it was incredibly helpful because I'm always running my laptop and my recorder and just being able to recharge batteries. The other thing is there are people who do amazing setups in Priuses. David Swanson in the book, who actually, if people find him online, he's amazing. He's blogging now. He's basically done segments of what amount to this incredible cooking show for people who are living out of Priuses. It's like luxury living in a very, very small space. He's a phenomenal cook. He has like a wood-burning oven for making pizza. And Priuses are incredible because they sip rather than guzzle gas. They can run climate control off a battery. It's like you've got a generator with you at all times. And it's this perfect little life support bubble. Of course, it's very small. But for modern minimalists, people are really doing it. It's funny, I drive a Prius back here in New York, and my partner, when I was actually out in the van recently, went all the way up to Providence using the Prius as a tent, kind of like car camping. And she made curtains to go in it, and they're really quite livable if you're a minimalist, and she is. I'm kind of hoarders without borders myself. But it's cool because the way when you're living that way, you are out in your environment so much. You're meeting people. You're really interacting with the landscape. There's something that's really refreshing. I mean, in New York, for example, there's so many of us all crammed together, but we're also in our places so much that everybody's kind of like this honeycomb. And one of the things I love about living here is the street culture, because it just spills out because we're all crammed together. I feel like when you look at like a modern suburb and stuff, so many people end up pretty isolated even by relative affluence. It's very weird. So when people are out on the road, you know, you're interacting with your landscape, with the people around you in a way that's incredibly immediate and refreshing.
Can we talk about the unbearable whiteness of vanning? You're white. Most of the people in the vanning community are white. It seems like even within this alternative lifestyle, white privilege is pretty pervasive.
Yes.
Would people of color be welcome? Would the prevalence of racial profiling pretty much preclude people of color from living this lifestyle? What is the general feeling?
Well, so this is really, really interesting to me because I see more people of color doing it now. I feel like the whole culture of living on the road has been getting into the mainstream more in recent years with the kind of very social media friendly hashtag van life, RVing for many, many years. I mean, the culture has been predominantly white. And also in recent years, gosh, when I was out there on the road, it felt like there was a shooting of an unarmed person of color who was a motorist like every other day.
Yeah.
By the police. And it was just epically terrifying to the point where once I got pulled over for not having my headlights on, and the police ended up giving me like, here are the sights you should see while you're in our community. Like, I felt like they were the welcome wagon, and this could have been a totally different experience. I was a young looking white woman traveling alone. So they're kind of like, oh, lost bunny rabbit, as opposed to we're going to profile you. At the same time, I have met, even after doing the book, people who are saying, I'm a person of color, I'm on the road, and I want to show other people you can do this. So I met a woman named Sharita, who is amazing. She was living in a minivan that she called Paint because it took her places she ain't. Incredible, incredible woman. She was, gosh, teaching Spanish and math. She was just kind of a one-woman army. And she met David Swanson, the guy who lived in the Prius, and they met up in Baja. And she was very conscious that many people of color weren't doing it. And she wanted to be out there showing people that this is something that should be accessible to everybody. And for the most part, she was having a really good experience. She was welcomed into the tribe of a lot of the people I met on the road. And everybody still talks all the time. But yeah, I think the willingness is there. I think like any community, there are going to be some jerks and some bigots. And just a matter of whether the other people are going to stand up and say, this is crap. I mean, it's a microcosm of our society, for better or for worse. It's a pretty white microcosm, and I hope it will get more diverse. But by the same token, it's, you don't want it to diversify just in terms of, oh, okay, more people have to do this now.
Right.
And it's everybody. So it's just a really complicated and nuanced situation. But I would love it to get to the point where anybody who wants to do it feels equally comfortable doing it. And I think there are a lot of people in the community who also believe in that.
Do you think more of us will end up choosing to live our later years out on the road?
You know, I think yes, but I also think it's going to get harder and harder because there's kind of a backlash on account of this being so darn trendy now. It was not really trendy when I started looking at it. And more you see this backlash against, essentially, you're seeing the criminalization of homelessness all over the country. And it's for people who live in vehicles or people who don't, or people who are just out on the street. And the idea is, even if you're on public land, we're going to hustle you along. Whether it's you're in a van and you can't sleep in your van overnight, even though you could park it overnight if you weren't in it.
Yeah.
That's something I personally find very offensive. To me, it says we value property over people. So like, this is a perfectly good place to keep your car overnight, but as long as you're not in it. I mean, what's that about? So I know, like, for example, right now in LA, there's a lot of legal wrangling going on as more and more people are doing this. The crackdowns have gotten pretty bad. So I worry that increased demand for this lifestyle will also make it harder for people who are already doing it to maintain it.
Let's end with an update on the lovely Linda. We leave her hopefully heading off into New Mexico to find out more about Earthship Homes and her plans to build her own Earthship on a piece of land that she purchased deep in the Arizona desert. What have the last 2 years held for Linda?
Well, it's been kind of crazy. Some stuff happened we did not expect. So first off, I did go to visit Linda in Arizona. My best friend and I went down there and we helped her with a greenhouse she was building. So she was trying her darndest to homestead out there and trying to figure out what her next step was. And then something crazy happened. Nomadland was optioned for film by Frances McDormand. And we're now in post-production. So Linda May and a whole bunch of other people from the book were part of the filming of this adaptation of Nomadland for film. The director is Chloe Zhao. It stars Frances and David Strathairn, along with Linda May and Swanky Wheels, with many other people from the community in speaking roles or as extras, including Bob Wells. The movie is in post-production. It's all been shot. Should be coming out in fall of 2020. And the cool thing about it is everybody got paid. And she is now homesteading in Taos with some other friends who are on the road, and they're now sharing a piece of land together, and her family is out there, and it's really, really exciting. She's not building an Earthship, but she's doing some other small sustainable building projects. I think she's just happy to be off the road and ready to homestead, and an Earthship is a huge undertaking and involves a lot of manual labor. So I think she's more up for a little instant gratification right now in terms of actually just getting to relax and enjoy herself, which I am utterly in favor of, although whenever I talk to her, she's still working on building something. So I'm hoping to get out there this spring and kind of roll up my sleeves and help do some building with her.
Jessica, it has been such a delight to talk to you. I'm so looking forward to seeing you on September the 24th. And thank you so much for writing this book and introducing all of us to such an incredible community of people that I really would have had no idea about without your book.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to read it and spend time with them and spend time with me too. So I'll be very much looking forward to the visit.
Thank you so much to Jessica Bruder. We spoke earlier this week on Skype. You are listening to Speaking of the Arts. And before we hand the airwaves over to Terry Gross and Fresh Air, I have a list of arts events coming up that would like to find their way onto your calendars. At Talking Horse Theatre, Aaron Krawitz and Adam Bretzky star in Red, a Tony Award-winning play about abstract expressionist painter Mark Rothko. You can catch Red tonight and tomorrow at 7:30, or there's a final 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday. In Jefferson City, it is opening weekend for Scene One Theatre's production of the musical of musicals, The Musical. Showtime is 7:30 and tickets are $15, and that show continues next weekend. At the Missouri Theatre tonight, there is a free showing of the documentary Only the Educated Are Free, The Journey of Michael A. Middleton, celebrating the life of the civil rights attorney and former interim University of Missouri System President, Mike Middleton. The film starts at 7 p.m. and no tickets are needed. Tonight at the Blue Note, the Como Comedy Club presents two shows with comedian Greg Warren, a former journalism school graduate from here in Columbia, most recently seen on Late Night with Seth Meyers, The Late Show, Late Show on CBS, and Last Comic Standing. His two shows tonight are at 7 and 9:30, and balcony tickets are $15. Tomorrow morning, the Boone History and Culture Center's Meet the Author series was to welcome Susan Kelly, but Susan is suffering from bronchitis, so in her place is Stephen Archer, former University of Missouri professor of theater, who will be talking about his memoir about growing up in rural Missouri. It's called I, Clodhopper, An Agrarian Getaway. Stephen's talk will be at 10:30, and that's free to attend. The University of Missouri's Theatre Department is holding auditions at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning for the upcoming Life and Literature series, Climate Change Theatre Action. Auditions are at the Rheinsberger Theatre and are open to any student or community member. There are no monologues to prepare. You can just show up. Tomorrow night, American R&B artist Son Little and Mary Ellen Kirk perform at Rose Music Hall at 9 p.m. for a $15 admission. And Out of Town, Violet and the Undercurrents perform at the Lupus General Store at 7:30. Sunday evening, Ozark-born country music artist Jody Lewis with Plain and Simple perform at Rose Music Hall at 5. And the North Village Arts District holds its annual First Friday fundraiser from 5:30 till 8 at The Roof atop the Broadway Hotel. Tickets are $20 and include light snacks, music by Sean Hennessy and David Pruitt, plus an art raffle and auction. Monday evening at 5:30, Ragtag Cinema has a free screening of the fictional comedy film The Big Short about the 2008 financial crisis. This film is showing in conjunction with this year's Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read program. Tuesday evening, there's another One Read event at the Reynolds Journalism Institute when three journalism school professors discuss the challenges and benefits of immersive and personal finance journalism. The panel discussion is from 6:30 till 8 and is free to attend. And at Daniel Boone Regional Library, Columbia author Tim Shearer will talk about his recent book, Crash the Gate, Doing 98, The Citizens Band Radio and American Culture. You can get your ears on at 7 p.m. for a journey back to America's first form of electronic social media. Wednesday evening, Daniel Boone Regional Library is hosting its annual One Read panel discussion moderated by KFRU's David Lyle and a four-person panel of local experts, including Richard Gleiman, a WorkAmper who has been living and working from his vehicle for the past 3 years. The discussion will be in the Friends Room from 7 till 8 p.m., and that is free to attend. The last show of the Lyceum Theatre's summer season opens next Thursday in Ararock. The musical Swingtime Canteen is a hilarious and heartwarming journey back to the music of the 1940s. Next Thursday's show is a 2 p.m. matinee and tickets are $42, and that show runs for 2 weekends. And finally, next Thursday, the State Historical Society of Missouri opens a show of the complete editioned Thomas Hart Benton lithographs in their brand new Center for Missouri Studies building on Elm Street. The opening is at 6:30 and it's free to attend. You have been listening to Speaking of the Arts on 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia with me, Diana Moxon, and my good friend and sound engineer, Mike Hagan. We'll be back next week with more news, views, and interviews on the arts in Mid-Missouri. Stay arty, Columbia.